This is Take Care, a health and wellness show produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. Today we're going to discuss the youngest members of society and their health.
Growing up today is a very different experience. Today's children are growing up with technology in their hands, so much so that they're sometimes called the I generation. Today's children are tomorrow's future.
And me, I'm Dora, 14.
And Billy, I'm 10.
And I'm Jane. I'm the littlest one who can talk very well.
We're youth. American youth. Americans of tomorrow.
We'll make the new records in sports. We'll bat 500 and do 100 yards in 9 seconds flat.
And one of us will be president.
Yes, we're youth. Americans of tomorrow. We're the strength of the nation. We and we alone are your every promise and hope for tomorrow.
And that's why we're spending the next hour exploring the health of our children. We'll take a look at how technology and the internet affect kids for the better and for worse. And we'll break down some recent studies that tell us what kinds of prescriptions the younger generation is taking and how diagnoses of autism spectrum disorder have increased in recent years.
But first, healing childhood adversity. Adversity isn't something that's exclusive to kids, but when it occurs early in life, toxic stress can have lasting effects. 2/3 of Americans are exposed to extreme stress in childhood, things like divorce, death, substance abuse, or sexual assault, and they can create both mental and physical issues down the road.
Our first guest is Dr. Darcy Lowell, a pediatrician and founder and CEO of Child First. Child First is an organization that helps struggling families build strong, nurturing relationships with the goal of healing and protecting children from the impact of trauma and toxic stress. It's taking a preventive approach to the problem. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Lowell.
Oh, thank you for having me.
There's been a lot of attention to the plight of migrant children and the trauma and stress they go through when they make their journey to a new country and sometimes get separated from their parents. But there are other kinds of trauma and stress that children face in dramatic situations in their lives. Stress is also part of life, and that's not what we're talking about here. What makes toxic stress different from that normal, everyday stress?
Well, the key between understanding what is toxic stress and what is normal stress has to do with a number of factors. One is, how severe is the stress? Is it chronic? Is it something that is overwhelming to the child? So that kind of stress is toxic. And so we can think about things like maternal depression, homelessness, extreme poverty, domestic violence, abuse and neglect. Those kinds of things are extraordinarily stressful in a child's world. The very most important factor, though, is, do you have a caregiving adult who is there to really care for that child, to hold that child physically and emotionally? That is the factor which differentiates stress that is toxic and really damages the developing brain and tolerable. So even in situations which are really very, very difficult for a young child, if there is that adult there to keep them safe, to have this kind of close relationship, nurturing relationship, then that child is not going to experience that stress as toxic. And toxic is really the right word, because we're talking about real damage to the developing brain, death of brain cells. This is not something that is light and we can just dismiss. This is really severe and affects the child for their whole life.
So how long have we known about toxic stress, and where did that term come from?
Well, actually, we've known that stress is bad for young children for a long time. But it wasn't until somewhere in the late 1990s, early 2000s, that we began to really understand and pull together the literature on how damaging this really was. And it was Jack Shonkoff who did a lot of this work, and he's actually the one who named toxic stress. But I think the main point here is that these kind of stressful experiences, in the absence of this buffering relationship, this nurturing parent-child relationship, are just as damaging, if not more damaging, to both the brain and the metabolic systems of the young child.
Tell us a little bit more about how toxic stress does affect a child's development and how it affects the child over the long term as they go into adulthood.
What we know is that the brain, basically, the very earliest years are the most important time, and that the brain is developing so rapidly during the first year in life. You have many of the cells are already in place, but it's the connections that are happening that are at an unbelievably rapid pace. Some have even quoted 1,000,000 per second. When you have this kind of stressful experience, it actually disrupts that process. Instead of the child being regulated, this kind of stress basically deregulates the whole metabolic system. You've heard about stress hormones, probably a rising cortisol that goes up, and that is what actually kills brain cells. But at the same time, what we know is that the environment is absolutely critical to how these connections are made and how really the architecture of the brain develops. There was a time when we thought it was all nature or biology that determined, you know, who we became, that DNA was all that was, you know, there, and that was kind of our blueprint. But what we know now is not nature, or it is nature and nurture combined together in this dynamic process. So what happens in that environment, whether or not that child is left alone, scared, frightened, in pain, with no one to comfort them, that's going to send those stress hormones sky high, and that is going to be wired in the brain as an experience. And the more times that is wired in the brain as experience, the more basically stable those connections become. And those actual experiences lead to proteins that are formed that hook onto the DNA and can turn the genes that determine who we are, on and off. This is called epigenetic modification, and that's a newer finding over the last 10 plus years, but that modification is absolutely critical in terms of gene expression. So we have these two things going on simultaneously: the changing of the genes, the wiring of the brain, the death potentially of brain cells, that are going to determine whether or not we all realize our potential and who we could be.
There's sort of an archetypal story that a person goes through a traumatic experience when they're young and it just makes them stronger, and then they become really successful in life. Can a child really recover from these toxic stress situations?
Yes, but it's not so much the stress itself. It is whether or not there is this nurturing, responsive relationship to prevent that stress from overwhelming the child's stress response system, the metabolic system. So in the case where those stresses, there's no buffer, and they just totally overwhelm the child, that is a very much more harmful situation than the same level of stress with a parent who is there to support and nurture a child, which is why there is so much talk now about what's happening with the young children being separated from their parents. And this is really documented chemically. It's documented in science that that relationship is so powerful to protect the young child's brain. And we also know that we can make changes even when we've had this kind of damage, but it's much harder later. But absolutely, we can do it.
Now, your approach at Child First, helping families that are struggling with these situations, is a little bit different. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that treatment model has evolved over the years?
We started developing the model in the late 1990s, and Child First officially began in 2001. And at the time, there was a lot of focus on the child alone, but not so much focus on the child in the context of the relationships and the stressors in the environment. And so our approach was, we need to do two different things simultaneously. We need to both help that family with all of the kinds of stress that they're experiencing, because that stress gets directly related to that child. So, you know, if a family is homeless, if they don't have enough to eat, if a parent has illness, if they have substance abuse, if there's depression, we need to be in there to help decrease the stressors that the family has experienced. But simultaneously, we need to work on that protective relationship, because they're unavoidable stressors. And certainly families living in poverty have them even more than so many others. But if we can actually come in and help heal that relationship, we can make a profound difference in terms of preventing future problems and future damage and healing the child and the parent. So this is a two-generation approach. both the child and parent from the kind of trauma that they've experienced. That is why we have actually a team approach. We have a mental health clinician who is a master's level, licensed, specially trained in early childhood mental health as well as adult mental health. And that individual works psychotherapeutically with the parent and child together. So they are healing at both ends, and they are building that nurturing relationship and what we call a secure attachment. And then we also have a care coordinator, who is the other part of the team, who is someone who's a bachelor's level and who knows about the services and supports in the community and is very actively involved with that parent or caregiver, understanding what their priorities are, what their goals are, and how to connect them to the kinds of services that will make their stress and their lives better. It's kind of like you're working from two different vantage points.
Your approach there at Child First sounds unique, but what do we as a society, the healthcare professions, need to be doing differently as a whole to help children overcome this adversity?
I think that, one, we've got to realize how important early relationships are and not dismiss them, like what's happening now. We can't do that because that is going to cause real, prolonged, lifelong damage. And I think just to say that the ACEs, all of the ACEs work, adverse childhood experience work, has shown us that this is not short term, that this is long term damage, not only in mental health, like depression and substance abuse, and not only in cognition and difficulties learning, but it's in things like we wouldn't think about heart disease, diabetes, obesity, hypertension, cancer, the things that are so critical. So that's why we absolutely have to pay attention.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Dr. Lowell.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Darcy Lowell, founder and CEO of Child First, an organization taking preventive measures to combat the effects of toxic stress on children and adolescents.
The child is father of the man. William Wordsworth wrote that line almost 150 years ago, when the world was familiar with poets, but not with psychologists. Perhaps the psychologists of Wordsworth's day didn't agree with the poet, but modern psychologists do agree. The child is father of the man. We know now that what happens to us as children has a far-reaching effect upon our later lives. That's why bringing up children is such an awful responsibility, yet such a beautiful experience.
Next, if you had to choose between physical education and state funding for your local school system, which would you choose? This is a decision many school districts across the country have to make on a yearly basis.
Our next guest doesn't think it has to be an either-or question. Dr. John Rady is a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. In his book, Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain, he argues that the same gym classes that typically get cut are the classes that could improve learning, test scores, and overall mental health among students. Our producer, Leah Landry, has the interview.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Dr. Rady.
Great to be with you.
So a typical physical education class in a K through 12 school probably isn't what it used to be. In some cases, that's for the better, but in many, it's not. What is the state of physical education in schools today?
Oh, it's on the decline. It's dropping. It has dropped. Recess is going away. Teachers are being harassed to teach to the test to get the test scores up. And with that, they eliminate some of the great subjects, especially PE. So you're seeing less and less time devoted to it and less interest in it.
So you've written that your inspiration for looking into exercise as it affects the brain came from a physical education program at a high school in Naperville, Illinois. Could you tell us a bit about Naperville?
Sure. It wasn't just a high school. It was the whole student body there of 19,000 children. I came to be aware of that when there was a frontline piece about this school district back in 2003. And at that point, only 3% of their kids were overweight of 19,000 kids. And that was pretty remarkable, given that the national average was 33%. Along with that, 99% of their kids had taken the TIMSS test, or the International Science and Math test that every country takes every 3 years to rate us how we're doing. And this past year, 2 years ago, we took it in the U.S., came in 18th and 19th in science and math, which is somewhat normal. Well, Naperville lobbied to take it as a country, competing with everybody, and they came in number one in the world in science and number six in math. That got me on an airplane to see what was going on because I was always interested in exercise and its effect on the brain, and we knew so much about how it affects mood and anxiety and stress, as well as how it can help prevent Alzheimer's disease. But I went there, and I was amazed to see what the program was, where all the kids took PE every day for 45 minutes. Most of the time, they were engaged in some activity to improve their level of fitness, and they focused on fitness first, which is not the way most programs go and have gone.
So how does exercise and physical fitness improve learning?
Well, it changes our brain chemistry, and then it changes the brain architecture. We have the chemistry change. Exercise increases the amount of cells that we use, and with that, we increase the neurotransmitters and other neurogrowth factors that help promote our brains to grow, and the way we learn anything is for our brains to grow. So it has an acute effect and a chronic effect, and making the chronic effect comes from being more fit, and when you're more fit, you have actually more brain cells that are available to you to take in information, as well as you're more primed and you've helped your brain be more healthy and able to deal with frustration and improve your attention system, which is really key and crucial.
In your book, Spark, I read that the teachers in the Naperville district were actually telling their students to take their hardest classes potentially right after gym period. Are there lasting effects of that regular physical activity as far as the brain is concerned?
Yes. As I say, there's an immediate effect, and that's what we call a natural history finding, where the teachers and the counselors were telling the children to take their hardest class right after they get their brains active and their bodies active. And then there's a longer-term effect where it begins to change our brain, like anything else that we do on a regular basis, and it makes the brain much more receptive to learn and to understand and to remember.
You also talk about Susan in Spark. She's an early middle age, and she is using wine as a coping mechanism for an out-of-control renovation project at her house. You actually settle on telling her to jump rope every time she feels stress instead of drinking to control it. So while students likely don't have to deal with home renovation worries, they do have a lot of other stressors. How does exercise affect stress levels, and how is that possible when exercise itself is actually a form of physical stress on your body?
It is a physical stress, but it's a stress that ends. The stress that you have when you're chronically worried is toxic stress. It doesn't go away. And to have the stress of exercise intercede, what you do is you build up reservoirs of what I call an internal janitorial service to help deal with the effects of stress on our nerves and our brain cells, and helps us readjust so that eventually we create more mechanisms to help us deal with stress so that it takes a higher load of threats from the environment to get us into a stressful, anxious state.
Later in the show, we're actually going to explore a recent study that shows more kids are being diagnosed with attention deficit disorders. What impact does activity have on ADD and ADHD?
Yes, well, this is how it all started for me, because that's one of the areas that I've spent 30 years writing and lecturing about. And we always, in our three books on attention deficit disorder, we talk about how exercise is certainly one of the most important components of treatment for our ADD kids. And you're seeing articles come out all the time now about exercise and sport and playing that have an effect on attention and helping. What you do is you do the same thing as Ritalin or Adderall does when you exercise. You increase the levels of dopamine and norepinephrine. I say that a bout of exercise is like taking a little bit of Prozac and a little bit of Ritalin, because you do the same things.
It does seem that some progress is being made when it comes to at least our collective understanding that movement is important. You know, fitness trackers are part of a lot of people's lives, telling them to get up and move around every 20 minutes. But at the same time, as you said in the beginning, schools are still struggling with this. Even in Illinois, where Naperville District 203 is located, I read that last year phys ed rules were adjusted, making it easier to cut classes or excuse kids from phys ed. What do you see as the future of physical education in this country?
I think people have to recognize the power of what being fit does to the learner, does to the learner's brain, does to their ability to take in information, to sort through it, to store it, to bring it back, to manipulate it in their minds. And then perhaps the world would begin to change and appreciate that this is a tool to make the learner a better learner. Countries that are aware of this are making rapid strides in reintegrating exercise into the school day, whether it be in a PE class or even in each classroom. In Holland and in Finland, they have constantly stress that the need for more exercise, even within the classroom, taking a 5-minute brain break, or in Finland, a 15-minute exercise break after every class. And they, by the way, Finland is among the top 5 countries when they look at scores on various tests, rating how well the kids are doing, and Finland is always up there. And a lot of it, or some of it, can be attributed to this very large focus on having their kids exercise and be fit.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Rady.
Thanks for having me on.
That was producer Leah Landry speaking with Dr. John Rady, professor of psychiatry and author of the book Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain.
We're going to take a short break here, but when we return, we look at the impact of technology on children, first with an internationally known expert on internet addiction, then with a doctor who's doing research on how a certain type of technology could reduce pain for children in the hospital. You're listening to Take Care from WRVO.
Welcome back. You're listening to Take Care. Today we're exploring the health of our children. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. When I was a kid, we didn't have the internet. And, you know, I'm not just playing the old man card here. Even the youngest members of our staff were just 1 or 2 years old when the internet came online.
Fast forward nearly 3 decades, and you can't get away from the internet or the technology it powers. And that means changes for how all of us spend our time, even children. Our next guest is an internationally known expert on internet addiction and the founder of the Center for Internet Addiction. Dr. Kimberly Young joined us to talk about the impact of the internet and technology on some of its youngest users. Dr. Young, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, as everyone probably knows, the internet is way more prevalent in our lives today than it was even a decade ago, and that goes for children as well. Even in the classroom, there's a lot more internet access and usage, and it gives endless knowledge, but it also has some problems. Internet use can become addictive. When does it move from that casual use for children to addictive behavior?
Well, I think for any addiction, you have to look at the warning signs. You know, is the person able to control their behavior? Have they lost interest in other activities because of the behavior? Have they jeopardized a relationship, an academic success, or a career? One of the things about addiction is there's usually a consequence to it. It's taking away from something else. It's become unmanageable. So those are the types of things. There's a big difference in terms of screen addictions from chronic checking, for example, to when it comes chronic and problematic and people have lost their jobs or gotten kicked out of school or gotten divorced over their activities.
And what are the ways it is destructive or harmful for children if they move over into that addictive behavior?
Well, the bigger things, I've been studying this for 20 years now. And back in the day, there was definitely an online and an offline life. And people would usually ask the questions, you know, how long is too long to spend online? But now there's just, everybody's just on. And the problem now is how young is too young is the real serious question. I mean, now we're seeing technology invade infants. You have the iPad bouncy seat with an iPad built right into an infant's bouncy seat. And you have all kinds of dangers related to that because children developmentally are behind still. They haven't really developed their own cognitive skills, so they could have a variety of problems. One of the things I talk more about these days, especially to parents and teachers, is the problem with children and screens. So you have social problems. They're not playing in groups. They're not learning how to talk in face-to-face conversations. They're just isolated in front of their screens. You have obesity. They don't have any motor play. They're just sitting there sedentary in front of screens. Or cognitively, they're not learning how to read a book. They're rather point and scroll and skim than using an actual book that's much more linear, much more page by page, and requires a whole different set of cognitive skills.
You mentioned that you've been studying this for a long time, since the beginning of the internet, and you founded the Center for Internet Addiction in 1995. But are we seeing more and more kids addicted to the internet as time goes on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I started this 20 years ago, we didn't even have email the way we talk about email today. It was a very different dial-up modem, you know, very slow. We certainly didn't have mobile technology. So all these things contributed to, I think, then a push for technology in classrooms, in businesses, with an over-reliance almost on it. And so now young children really are in a very different position than they were two decades ago, or like you said, a decade ago. Now we're seeing it in kindergarten class. That really is much too young. And we're one of the few countries that just seems to allow it. We don't really recognize internet addiction as other countries do. I mean, we've been lagging behind in the U.S.
I said at the beginning that you can get addicted, but there is some controversy over whether it's an actual addiction, if it's, you know, different than, say, alcohol addiction or drug addiction. What's your stance on this?
Well, obviously, I mean, after studying it for 20 years, there's a preponderance of information and validity in academic peer-reviewed research that says this is. Again, the controversy is only in America. I was at the first International Congress on Internet Addiction Disorders. It was held in Milan, Italy. That was in 2013. I was the only American there. And all the other countries really were looking at us and saying, what's going on? Why aren't you doing more to address this very serious issue? For example, in Korea, all in their curriculum, they have prevention programs for kids. They talk about screen usage. They have treatment centers set up for this. And it's, you know, a very different culture than ours. I understand that. But still, we're really not doing a whole lot except to say promoting what is not really a benign tool. Apple just came out with an app, at least trying to monitor screen use in their phones. And I think that's a step in the right direction. What's been happening in America, unfortunately, it's like the nicotine industry. We knew that nicotine was addictive for so long, but it wasn't until a class action lawsuit against Philip Morris that we really started saying, oh my, now we need to change what we think about in terms of our smoking habits. But before that, it was promoted with movie stars and Joe Camel and teenagers. So I think we're in the same sort of iteration with internet addiction. At some point, there needs to be that tipping point.
Well, what do you think parents should do if they are concerned about their child's internet habits? I mean, a lot of parents themselves can't pry themselves away from the phone. What do you recommend?
Well, I developed the 3-6-9-12 parenting guidelines, and this is very helpful because at each developmental age, a child needs, I think, a different use of technology. So from infancy to three, there's no technology, no screens, no media. But then from, say, 3 to 6, the child can have very limited, very scrutinized, monitored screen use. And then from 6 to 9, you know, a bit more independence with the screens. And then from 9 to 12, and so forth. I mean, you start seeing a gradual use. And so the guidelines have been very helpful, I know, in a lot of the work I do with parents, because sometimes nobody's really told them that. They're just like, well, what do we do? And it really does make sense. And I've seen this, you know, a 9-year-old is going to be different than a 3-year-old's need to be online.
You talk about a digital diet. It's almost like there needs to be nutritional guidelines for the internet.
Well, we do a lot with our patients here. We talk about digital dieting and digital nutrition to the extent that it really parallels eating disorders. you know, for a food addict, you're not going to say, well, just quit food as the answer. It's really about making healthy, positive choices. Same thing with the technology. It's not just saying abstinence is the way to treat addiction in this case. It's really about making healthier, better choices about how you consume technology.
It's different than a drug addiction where you can live without taking drugs, but if you want to be a modern functioning adult, you do need technology these days. So how do you balance that?
Again, when we talk about internet addiction, it really is oftentimes for the more recreational things, things like pornography, gambling, gaming. You know, people are using it responsibly for work. You know, they're production engineers and they're on the computer a lot, whatever it might be. That's legitimate and balanced use. Or making airline reservations for a vacation. So there's really very good things to be doing with the technology. It really is about finding your own balance. A lot of times we make individual treatment plans with our patients because everybody's goals are different. You have a 21-year-old gamer that really dropped out of school and living in his parents' basement, might be qualitatively different in terms of what his balance is versus, say, a 58-year-old man who's probably watching pornography sites and it bothers his wife, and we need to figure out what the reason is in their marriage, that there might be a problem that he's doing that. So a lot of the outcomes vary, which makes it harder to treat than alcoholism. Alcoholism has one main component, which is abstinence, where here abstinence really isn't the key.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot more study to be done as we continue to rely on the internet, and I'm sure you'll be at the forefront of that. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Young.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Psychologist Kimberly Young is an expert on internet addiction. You can find out more about the topic in her latest book, Internet Addiction in Children and Adolescents, Risk Factors, Assessment, and Treatment.
There are also ways, though, in which technology is making things easier and in some cases better for kids, especially those who find themselves in the hospital often. At Children's Hospital Los Angeles, doctors and nurses are using virtual reality to make things like routine blood draws easier for kids.
Joining us to discuss these efforts is Dr. Jeffrey Gold, clinical psychologist and director of the Pediatric Pain Management Clinic in the Department of Anesthesiology Critical Care Medicine at the hospital. Here's producer Mark Lavonier with the interview.
Thanks a lot for joining us on Take Care, Dr. Gold.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How is virtual reality used at your hospital and even at other hospitals today?
So virtual reality was first introduced in a pediatric hospital setting for the purposes of painful procedures, and we used it as a form of distraction during wound care, some of my colleagues up at University of Washington. And then I started using it here at Children's Hospital Los Angeles to attenuate pain around blood draw in phlebotomy. And we've also used it for other more routine procedures like IV placement, PICC lines, and other types of painful routine procedures.
So it would be used in the instances where basically a pediatric patient has to be very still?
Yeah, they don't always have to be perfectly still because the current virtual reality gaming environments are more wrapped to the head, sort of through a head-mounted display. People are developing games where you can use eye gaze to actually engage in the environment or the experience. Their head can move around if their arms are still where the procedures are usually happening, like a blood draw might be, you know, in your arm or an IV in the back part of your hand. We're able to engage them in these activities while they're going through those types of procedures.
This reminds me of when I was much younger and I was getting an ultrasound on my heart, and the doctor at the time had put on a Looney Tunes cartoon, which I will never forget. It was Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd falling from a plane during World War II, and they were falling out of the plane for about 10 minutes.
Wow.
And I remember that not being a very comfortable experience to distract me from, you know, the scary-looking screen and seeing the inside of myself. So what sort of reaction have you had from these children so far?
Well, I think that's a great example because obviously that environment that they exposed you to was, I mean, people have fear of heights or fear of falling, so that kind of creates an anxious response. So we use environments or create environments that are more engaging and fun and light and can bring some sense of humor, but also has time-based and points and earning levels. So it's a very engaging process for the kids to play and to want to get to that next level. And what we know is through attention and concentration and focus, while flooding sort of the visual senses, the auditory senses, sometimes tactile senses, that you can engage more attention and concentration into the game and away from the procedure that's happening. The games that we're developing are focused more around having fun in a developmentally appropriate way. So we have to have games that are appropriate for 8-year-olds or 10-year-olds as well as 16 and 18-year-olds.
VR can occasionally produce dizziness and other, let's say, mild discomforts. Do you run into this or other downsides when you're using VR for this kind of application?
We talk about simulator sickness, and you know, I've probably run close to 300-400 children through the virtual environments that we have here at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, and we have not had kids report simulator sickness. However, you do hear reports of it in adults. I think as we age, we're a little more sensitive to that movement. And if the tracking is off in a game, if you're moving too quickly and the game's not keeping up with your head movement, that sort of discordant movement can cause some lightheaded or dizziness. For the most part, we haven't had any reports of that in the pediatric population.
What's it been like for that first-time user of VR? You know, a patient coming in that's never used the technology.
No, that's a great question. I mean, when we first approach a potential participant and we introduce the study, they're often very excited. People have heard about it, but still not a large population from our hospital has used it. And so there's often excitement. Sometimes if they're randomized to not getting virtual reality during the procedure, they're a little disappointed, but they get to play it after the procedure because we're trying to control for the VR gaming versus nothing to have a comparison group. So they're excited about it and they're interested and they want to play. And often when they're done playing, they'll say things like they want to do that again, or is this always going to be offered here? Often the kids are laughing, and actually often the healthcare provider or the parents are giggling and laughing along with the kid because it's kind of a funny experience. You know, they're just watching the kid move around with the head-mounted display, and they're just are so shocked how calm and relaxed the kid is. And often, you know, kids will finish and say, "Have you drawn my blood yet?" or "Have you done it yet?" We recently introduced virtual reality into a Botox clinic. We have a neuromuscular disorders clinic where kids come in with contractures and they get serial Botox injections. And the physician and nurse practitioner asked our team to come in and to trial it with a couple of patients. And so the first patient we tried, we put him into the virtual environment to play this game. And then the physician and nurse practitioner proceeded to inject the child, I would say maybe about 8 or 9 times with Botox into the areas where this child had contractures as a result of, say, cerebral palsy. The kid was 100% still, calm, giggling and laughing. And I looked over toward the mom, and the mom just started crying because they come all the time for these injections, and it's always a tussle. He's resistant to it. He cries. He gets upset and frustrated. At the same time, the nurse practitioner, every time she's injecting him with the Botox, is just uttering under her breath, "Oh my gosh, I cannot believe this. I have never seen this before. This is unbelievable." It made the procedure go so quick and easy. The mother was just, she said it was a miracle. I said to my staff, she used the M word, "It's a miracle." And so that was a really touching experience. And since then, we've been back in the Botox clinic providing VR for kids that are very similar to that one that I described. And we're seeing really outstanding results.
What happens in the body when someone is using VR that leads your team to believe that it could be a great way to manage pain?
Well, what we learned from the last article that we just published in the Journal of Pediatric Psychology was that the kids who have what's called anxiety sensitivity, which is this idea that you have more physiological arousal, like heart rate, blood pressure, respiration, the kids who have increased anxiety sensitivity are the kids that seem to be benefiting the most from the VR intervention. So those are the ones who are able to, through the engagement in the virtual experience, they're able to down-regulate their physiological symptoms and feel less anxious. So we have decreased anxiety and decreased pain because we know that emotional states and nociceptive pain, or like tissue damage, those go hand in hand. So if you have tissue damage, like from a needle stick, that makes you anxious. If you're anxious, that can create more pain around the needle stick. So these parameters are related to one another. So it's important to be able to regulate emotion toward pain as well as pain toward emotion. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. And it seems that that individual group of patients wouldn't necessarily be targeted, but they would benefit the most from the technology.
Correct. Absolutely. I mean, I think we're still early in virtual reality science to understand who's best matched for which interventions, which game experiences, whether you're a boy or a girl, or whether you're a school-age child or a teenager or an adult. I mean, we're learning as we study in larger cohorts, we're better understanding sort of the personalized medicine approach, if you will, to virtual reality. So customizing that which is an ideal scenario or an ideal virtual experience for that child to minimize any distress, pain, or anxiety that they're having as a result of the procedure. And again, you know, at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, we've started primarily in that acute pain management space, but our goal is to move into other areas like chronic pain management and introduce virtual environments that will be useful for patients with chronic pain to downregulate pain, anxiety, and stress.
Sounds like there's so many possibilities yet to be explored. Dr. Jeffrey Gold is a clinical psychologist and director of the Pediatric Pain Management Clinic at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. He's also a professor at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Thanks a lot for being with us today, Dr. Gold.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was producer Mark Lavonier speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Gold, a clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital Los Angeles.
On the other side of the country, in New York State, administrators, mental health counselors, and teachers are coming together to address mental health in their curriculum.
For teens facing depression, stress, and other mental health problems, suicide can seem like the only way out. It's the third leading cause of death for Americans between the ages of 10 and 24, according to the Centers for Disease Control. As Payne Horning reports, New York State educators are now trying to alleviate the problems mental health are causing their students by addressing the issue head on.
When college professor Michelle Bartholomew Green isn't using her home office computer to teach online classes, she's using it to listen to music. One song she often listens to is Monster by Skillet, her son Eric's favorite, which she says has taken on new meaning since he took his own life 5 years ago at the age of 18.
I knew it was about teenage stuff, and now that he's gone, I really understand why that song, I think, spoke to him. He must have been feeling so out of control.
Eric was a freshman at Alfred State College in Western New York when he died by suicide. Green, who was a professor at the college, says she kept tabs on Eric and met with him to catch up at least once a week. But it wasn't until after his death that she discovered he was suffering from depression, stress, and anxiety.
His roommate shared with me that Eric was talking about how he was never going to be successful. He was never going to make anything of himself. To me, if someone says that to me, I know that they're contemplating taking their own life. In our society, we don't really teach people to look out for those kinds of things, especially not young people. And so his roommate at age 18 did not really understand what Eric was saying to him. I think Eric was saying that he was going to kill himself.
In an effort to make more students aware of those warning signs, Green donated $10,000 to the Baldwinsville School District, where she relocated after Eric's death, to fund mental health training and programs for staff and students. It's training that all students in the state from the elementary level to high school will soon be exposed to. This fall, New York State will become the first in the nation to require mental health information in school curriculum. The goal is to introduce students to what mental health is, how they can cope with it, and where to seek help. Penny Williams is the Youth Development Director for Onondaga, Cortland, Madison, Boces, which is designing the curriculum for school districts in central New York.
For students, it goes back to identification of feelings and emotions, regulation of those feelings and emotions, and building empathy and understanding of others with differences.
New York State recommends schools broach this subject in health classes, but Williams says the information can be addressed in any course, and she says equally important to equipping students with the skills to handle mental health problems is preparing staff to recognize those who are struggling.
If a teacher just recognizes that this student, who used to be verbal, verbose, talked in class, and now has become quiet, sitting in the corner, she or he notices that, then brings it up to the appropriate people. That's what would be helpful.
That model of getting staff to be advocates is currently in use at West Genesee School District in Syracuse.
All right, you're all set. Have a good day.
There, all school staff, including the custodians and food service workers, have been trained to watch after the students in group settings, like at lunch, for any signs that they may be distressed. Superintendent Chris Brown says they're not only trying to encourage more connections between students and teachers, but between students and their peers as well.
With the number of broken homes that we have nowadays, or the number of homes that are together but mom and dad have four jobs, I think the biggest thing is relationship building. I just don't think you can understate the power of building a relationship with a child.
Michelle Bartholomew Green says New York's new law is a step in the right direction, and she's hopeful that it can prevent other children from resorting to suicide.
We do have an obligation, I think, to teach our kids how to cope. I think that's just as important as reading, writing, and arithmetic.
For Take Care, I'm Payne Horning in Baldwinsville.
Coming up, the latest in health when it comes to our children. We'll break down a few recent studies exploring prescription medication and autism diagnoses. You're listening to Take Care from WRVO Public Media. Thanks for joining us on Take Care, where we discuss health and wellness. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. Our specific focus today is the health of our children, what some are calling the I generation and Gen Alpha. So far, we've discussed mental health and physical health and explored how technology has changed the way people spend their young lives. We turn now to the latest in health.
More children are being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. By some estimates, the national average is up 19%. According to new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, autism now affects 1 in 59 children. That's up from the previously reported 1 in 68.
We spoke to a pediatric psychologist and autism researcher who leads the CDC's New Jersey autism study to get his take. Dr. Walter Zaharodny is an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Rutgers New Jersey Medical School. He says the increase is a significant change and one that could continue.
We've been tracking autism now for 15 years, and we have additional information based on some pilot studies with four-year-olds. And that information, together with our trend exploration, suggests that we haven't yet peaked, that autism prevalence will be higher.
Zaharodny says there isn't a clear reason why more kids are being diagnosed with autism, and in fact, he says some children may be missed.
I guess I would emphasize the importance that we do indeed continue having universal autism screening at 18 and 24 months. I guess I would add to that that it's probably also useful to screen at 30 months or 32 months, because it's clear that the current screening procedures are missing children who are positive for autism.
Zaharodny said that there's still room for improvement in screening methods. Tests that are more sensitive to detecting autism and more specific to avoid false positives, especially as diagnoses rise.
There have been decreases, though, overall, in the use of prescription medications among U.S. children and adolescents. Another study from the CDC shows that trend over a 15-year period. We discuss results with Dr. Craig Hales, a preventive medicine physician at the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics.
Overall, we found a decrease in percentage of children and adolescents who used a prescription medication in the last 30 days, from 25% down to 22%, with the biggest increase among infants 0 to 23 months old.
Dr. Hales was the lead author of the study, in which researchers also looked at trends when it comes to different classes of medications.
We found that asthma medications, antibiotics, and ADHD medications were the most common types of prescription medications used.
The study showed that kids today are being prescribed fewer antibiotics, antihistamines, and upper respiratory combination medications, while the prevalence of asthma medication, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder medication, and contraceptive use increased in certain age groups. Significant differences were also seen when a child's insurance status came into play.
For youth that had some type of insurance, 23% of them were using at least one type of prescription medication, whereas only 10% of the uninsured kids were taking a prescription medication.
Dr. Hales and other researchers don't know why that is. For example, they don't know if the uninsured children needed a particular medication that was too costly given their uninsured status, but that could be an area of future study.
Youth is not an easy time. Let every man look back for himself and remember. The problems are many. And today, with the world in chaos and no city or town in this nation too small or too remote to be affected, those problems have quickened and grown. The future of this generation of American youth is in our hands as well as theirs. Because we demand much of them, it's our duty to point and lead the way toward the goal we've set. The task is not an easy one, but help can be found ready to hand.
Thanks for joining us for Take Care from WRVO Public Media. You can find more on the latest health and wellness topics online at WRVO.org and on iTunes. We'd love your suggestions, too. Email us at takecare@WRVO.org.
Today's show was made possible by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. The show was written, recorded, and produced by the Take Care team. That's me, Catherine Loper, Mark Lavonier, and Leah Landry. Mark also composed all of the music you hear during the show. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. Thanks for joining us for Take Care, produced by WRVO Public Media.